the podcast from Belmont Chapel in Exeter, sharing the story, living the life. For more information, go to belmontchapel.org.uk.
Let's read together, shall we, from the Bible. If you have one of these green Bibles in front of you on the chairs, we're looking at Ephesians chapter 5. We're only reading about four verses from there, but it might be useful to have it open in front of you. If you have no idea where Ephesians 5 is, it's page 1111. So page 1111, and we'll read just a few verses from that page. We're doing a series at the moment in this church about the kinds of things that we expect of folks who are members here at Belmont. We do a membership course when people first join us, and it's a five-week affair with videos and sessions and all sorts of stuff. And the problem is, there's always a danger that you'll go through that stuff and say, yes, 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 where do I sign? Come into the church. Then we never mention it again. And so we develop our own kind of idea as time goes by of what it means to be a member, and we make adjustments mentally without realizing we're making them. It's always good to be reminded of what you commit yourself to when you start. And if you're not a member yet, if you're not even a Christian yet, well, listen anyway, because this will give you more of an insight than I guess 99.99% of people have in Exeter out there of what it really means to live the Christian life. So there are four big things in the membership course: knowing, growing, caring, and sharing. And we're on the sharing one today, and that's where these verses fit in. So let's read Ephesians chapter 5, verse 8 through to verse 11. This is what it says. The Apostle Paul's writing to a bunch of people who have become Christians in the second biggest city in the Roman Empire, and he says this: "For you were once darkness, but now you're light in the Lord. Live as children of light. For the fruit of the light consists in all goodness, righteousness, and truth, and find out what pleases the Lord. Have nothing to do with the fruitless deeds of darkness, but rather expose them." And that's where our reading ends. But let's just read on for a few more verses just for context. "It's shameful even to mention what the disobedient do in secret," he says, "but everything exposed by the light becomes visible. And everything that is illuminated becomes a light, becomes enlightened. This is why it is said, 'Wake up, sleeper, rise from the dead, and Christ will shine on you.'" Well, that's our reading, and we've called this talk this morning, "Committed to God's World." There are two kinds of people in the world. You put that phrase into Google and see what comes up. It's fascinating, really. One of the most famous examples of the phrase being used, I suppose, was the movie The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, where a bunch of dubious characters are trying to dig up some buried treasure, and Clint Eastwood says at one point in the film, famous quote, "You see, in this world there's two kinds of people, my friend, those with loaded guns and those who dig. You dig." But this idea that there are two kinds of people, that you can divide humanity into two bits, comes up again and again. In fact, there's a blog called twokindsofpeople.tumblr.com where a Portuguese artist has tried to define the world in two groups. Now, let's just do a quick check here. How many people are in the left-hand category? Put your hand up if you are. You prefer to see the paper going that way. How many people are in the right-hand category? Whoa! Significant Belmont bias there. Well, that's interesting. Try this one then. How many people start from the crust and how many people start from the point? How many people start from the crust? Not many. How many people start from the point? Of course you do. It's a natural way to do it. Anyway, how many people wear the baseball cap the right way around? And how many people wear it back to front to show the rebels? How many people the right way around? They're the correct people. Where are the rebels? Oh, yes, interesting bunch. Not many are admitting to it since I put it that way, but still, there you go. How many people prefer those cool little earbuds that almost vanish into your ears? And how many people like me, okay, that's thank you. And how many people like me find them falling out all the time so I have to wear these great big monstrosities from the 60s? Yes, I know how that works, yes, okay, fair enough. And when you cut a piece of toast, how do you cut it in the middle? How many people cut it right through the middle in that left-hand way? That's boring. How many people like me cut it diagonally? Not so many. How many people, when they're reading a book, put a bookmark into it? And how many people fold back the corner of the page? You illiterate Philistines. God. Fair enough. How many people tear off neatly the squares of chocolate they're going to eat? Mm-hmm. Oh, a bunch of very orderly people where chocolate's concerned. How many people just bite into it? Oh, I'm finding out stuff about Belmont this morning. This is really interesting. How many people prefer the old analog face of watches? Oh, a lot of traditionalists around this place. Yep. And how many people prefer the digital one that tells you in numbers? Not many. Only a couple of people. Wow, that's amazing. And I think this is the last one we've got. How many people just need one alarm to get them up in the morning? And how many people... Okay, well, many people saying that's good for them. How many people need a lot of alarms to get them going? 5 minutes later, snooze, wake up. Oh, no, it's that time. Yeah, okay, fair enough. Thank you very much. And there's a lot you can do with stuff like this, obviously. There's a firm, a food firm called Zomato who's done a whole series of adverts based on it. When you go out for a meal, do you focus on the menu and what you can actually eat, or do you focus on the price column? Two kinds of people in the world. There are two kinds of people in the world. One drinks Coke and the other drinks Pepsi. Two kinds of people in the world. One pays the bill gladly and the other one says, I'll just go to the washroom when the bill comes round. The two kinds of people, there are the coffee drinkers, there are the tea drinkers. There are two kinds of people in the world. I love this one. Those who can extrapolate from incomplete data. The scientists are getting it. Okay, fair enough. There are two kinds of people in the world. Morning people and people who want to shoot morning people. I won't ask who's who. You're all here and it's morning, so that's pretty good. There are basically two kinds of people in the world. Those who build sandcastles and those who destroy other people's. And it's a fascination, isn't it? Dividing human beings into two groups. Here's one that just says we're all different. Two kinds of people in the world, you and everyone else. But I think the best one actually was Robert Benchley, the humorist, who said there are two kinds of people in the world, those who believe there are two kinds of people in the world, and those who don't. But maybe the best comment of all was made not by a human, but by a cat. There are two kinds of people in this world, and I don't like them. It's easy to generalise about people, isn't it? And to say there are two kinds of people, there are those that are like me, there are those like somebody else. But actually, that's exactly what's going on in this passage we looked at this morning. The Apostle Paul divides people in the world into two separate categories. And he talks about it as such a sharp difference as light on the one hand and darkness on the other. And he says, look, you guys who are Christians, realize what's happened to you. You've not just drifted into a religious opinion. You've not just joined a new club. You've not just tried on a new religious attitude for size. You have been through a revolutionary, galvanizing, world-shaking change. You've come right out of darkness, and now you're in the light. It's that big. And the Bible talks about light and darkness all the way through. And Paul's tapping into a theme that runs right through Scripture for thousands of years before he comes along. God starts in creation with something that's without form and void, and into it he brings his light. And the difference between light and darkness, the shootout between light and darkness, goes on down through the ages. And Paul says here, what's happened when Jesus came to die on the cross was that light came back into the darkness in a way that had never happened before. Jesus was the light, and John's gospel says, the light shines on in the darkness, and the darkness has never put it out. This world is a dark world, and if the light of God could ever be extinguished, it would have been. But the darkness never puts out the light. And Jesus came to make a big difference. 2 Corinthians says, for God who said, let light shine out of darkness, has shone in our hearts to give the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ. That's what's happened. Now, you may have become a Christian in a very kind of unexciting kind of a way. You may have grown up in a Christian family, learned about it all in Sunday school, accepted it just normally, kind of in the course of things that are going on, made a commitment along with 20 others at a Devon Christian youth camp or something like that, and just have felt, well, it's always been part of me. Never lose sight of the fact that you've come from darkness into light. You've changed. There's been a massive, massive change from your old original nature that you're born with. Peter, another New Testament writer, puts it like this. If you're a Christian, you're a chosen people, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, God's special possession, so that you may declare the praises of him who called you out of darkness into his wonderful light. One of my favourite translations of the New Testament was J.B. Phillips' translation. He was a vicar in the East End of London who found that the kids in his church couldn't understand the authorised version, the King James Bible. So during the Blitz, he started scribbling out his own paraphrase of what the Bible actually meant. And throughout the 1950s, with the help of C.S. Lewis, he got it published as one of the first modern versions in English. This is how he puts this passage. You are God's chosen generation, his royal priesthood, his holy nation, his peculiar people. All the old titles of God's people now belong to you. It's for you now to demonstrate the goodness of him who has called you out of darkness into his amazing light. And he goes on, in the past you were not a people at all. Now you are the people of God. In the past you had no experience of his mercy, but now it is intimately yours. If you're a Christian, something miraculous has happened to you. You've come out of darkness, and now you're in the light. Here's how another passage of Paul's puts it. He's rescued us from the kingdom, dominion of darkness, and brought us into the kingdom of the Son he loves, in whom we have redemption, the forgiveness of sins. You've left one kingdom, the kingdom of darkness, and come into blazing light. Sometimes it doesn't always feel like that. You don't feel you know and understand very much. You don't feel as if anything big has happened to you. But depend on it, you are in a very, very privileged position indeed. And so, as Bob Dylan realized when he first became a Christian, doesn't matter how much money you got, he says, there's only two kinds of people. Oh, there we go again. There's saved people and there's lost people. And that's the difference. If you are saved, if you have been rescued by God and brought into the kingdom of the Son he loves, then you're one kind of person. If you're still in the darkness, then you're another. And if you're in the light, you have an awesome responsibility to the people who are in the dark. That's why we make so much of it in Belmont Church membership. How you impact the outside world. Because you see, it's not like the people of light are over here, the people of darkness are over here, and they've got the light, and they've got the darkness. What is darkness, after all? Darkness is just the absence of light. So it's not that I've got the light and you've got the darkness and we're on different planets. No, it's I've got the light, you've got nothing. And if I don't share what I've got with you, you've got nothing forever. And so the people of the light have to penetrate the darkness. Paul says, and at the end of that passage, doesn't he? Everything that's shone upon by the light becomes light, becomes illuminated. Bring the light into the darkness, the shadows flee away, there's no darkness any longer. And so we have a responsibility to be people of the light. Now, sometimes people might get a little bit annoyed about what I'm saying, because they say, you're saying that Christians are full of light and other non-Christians are full of darkness. Isn't that an arrogant way to talk? I don't think it is. Let me just make 3 points in the course of this talk. Here's number one. First, the difference between light and darkness is extremely important. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying Christians good, non-Christians bad. Christians on the way to heaven, non-Christians going to hell. I'm not saying it's that way. I'm not saying darkness means you can do nothing right and that light means you can do nothing wrong. I know some pretty ropey Christians, and I'll bet you do. I'm one of them. And I know some very, very good non-Christian people. It's not a question of their morality. Nor is it just a question of their ability to understand. Because I know some Christians who don't understand very much. And to be honest, when I listen to them explaining why they believe, I think, oh my goodness, oh dear. Because they don't really seem to have too much of a logical connection between their brain and the way they act in life. And I know some non-Christians who understand profoundly and brilliantly concepts which some of those simple Christians don't. You can't take away from the intellectual acumen and the brilliance of people like Christopher Hitchens, Richard Dawkins, Sam Harris, and the New Atheists. You can't do it. They're clever, clever people. So we're not talking about moral status, necessarily. And we're not talking about intellectual status, necessarily. What we're talking about is what people understand. If you look at the people who were alive when Paul was writing these words, for instance, around about AD 64, there was Seneca, one of the greatest and most profound philosophers of his day, brave man as well, who the next year, actually, when he was told by a crooked king to kill himself,
realized there was nothing else to be done and slit his veins on order and died cheerfully because he was somebody who had his life together. He was a great philosopher. He was somebody who understood what life was about. Then there's Josephus, Flavius Josephus. He was around at the same time. One of the greatest Jewish historians of all time. One of the greatest scholars of the Old Testament you could hope to have. Then there was Lucan, the satirist, one of the most profound authors of Latin literature, still read today, tremendous stylist, wonderful man in terms of his literary ability, and a man of unflinching honesty and rigor and morality as well. And the way he flayed immorality and wrong in Rome was tremendous to watch. There was Musonius Rufus as well, a man who lived for peace, a philosopher who was able, brave enough to stand up in front of an army and say, "No, don't fight, lay down your arms, go home, peace is better than war." He almost got himself killed as a result of it. Great men. And yet they're the kind of people living in his day of whom the Apostle Paul is saying, they're in the dark. They are the people of darkness. And you, Christians, even if you're nothing like as eminent or wise or profound as these guys, you are people of the light. At the same time, ranging a bit further widely, there was Boudica, living in Britain, a daughter of a king who saw her daughters taken and raped and killed in front of her, who knew all about the treachery of the Romans to their promises, who instead of giving in became one of the bravest resistance fighters you could possibly hope to find, a woman of incredible courage and integrity. There was Hero of Alexandria down in Egypt, inventing the steam turbine in the first century AD, one of the most brilliant scientists and philosophers of his day. There were people like Wang Chong in China, again, a great rationalist philosopher, somebody who insisted on logical evidence for anything that anybody believed, hundreds of years ahead of his time. And all of these, the Apostle Paul is saying, are people of the darkness. So he wasn't having a go at non-Christians and saying they're worthless, they can't do anything, they don't understand anything. What does it mean to be in darkness? And what does it mean to be in light? Because if what the Apostle Paul is saying is right, some of the most brilliant people in our world, some of the best and most attractive people in our society are in darkness, and we have the job of showing them the light. Well, somebody who thought a lot about this was the old Welsh preacher, Martin Lloyd-Jones, and he wrote a series on the whole book of Ephesians, which stretches to the whole bookshelf, and this is his commentary on 4:17 to 5:17. Pretty much the verses we're doing this morning. So it's going to be a long session. I hope you brought your sleeping bag. But he wrote a lot more than we're going to get through this morning. But he did write this book called Darkness and Light, specifically about these verses. And he said, darkness affects every area of your personality. Now, Martin Lloyd-Jones was a trained psychologist. And he thought about the human being in terms of mind, will, and emotions. And he says, when you're in the dark, it doesn't mean you're a bad person. Doesn't mean you're a stupid person. But it does mean that each of those areas of your personality has been affected by the fact that this is a dark world in which God isn't completely obvious. First of all, he says your mind is affected. Non-Christians just don't understand the Christian message. And it's almost as if there's a barrier preventing them from understanding what it's about. And I've often found myself trying to explain to people at school who are intelligent folks on their way to Oxbridge with 4 A-star A-levels exactly what the Christian message is all about, and they still don't get it. And you can understand what the New Testament says, that the God of this world has blinded the minds of those who don't believe. There's something that's just difficult to see about the gospel until the penny drops. And that's sometimes, I think, why people who are not too complicated in their minds can become Christians much faster than those who do have a strongly analytical mind and can see lots of different possibilities, because they overcomplicate the story, they don't quite understand it. And most people don't know much about Christianity. Don't be deceived. You walk down the high street today, ask a few people, do you know about Christianity? Oh yeah, I had that in school. Yes, I know all about that. Okay, quote me one verse from the Bible. Tell me what the basis of the Christian message is. You'll find, if you probe, most people know absolutely nothing about Christianity. Doesn't it stop them pontificating about it? And the learned ones from pontificating about it in the papers and on TV and so on and so forth. And with high-sounding phrases, you can mask your ignorance, make it sound as if you understand something. But actually, a lot of people just don't understand how simple Christianity is. God is offering you a free gift, the gift of life. There is nothing you can do to get it apart from take it. And he just wants you to accept it as a free gift from him. What's so difficult to understand about that? Yet people don't get it. And Lloyd-Jones goes on to say, darkness also means that your will is affected. You cannot live in the way that you know you should, no matter how you try. And that's the history of our planet, isn't it? You see, great people who thought amazing thoughts, who've had the most incredible aspirations in life, just not able to live up to them. And something in us drags us down again and again. And somebody once said, every life seen from within seems just like a series of failures. And I'll bet you know that feeling, because I do. Other things that other people don't see, you realize again and again, are one more compromise, one more failure. And you cannot live in the way you want to, because your will is in the dark. And finally, there's your emotions. And Martin Lloyd-Jones says that's the third thing. So many people just don't want to change. They don't want to know God. They don't want to think about it. Oh, if there's a God there and there's anything after this life, I'll sort that one out when I get there. That's like driving your car up a hill, being stopped by a policeman who says, don't drive on round the corner, there's been a landslide and the road disappears and you'll go over the edge, and saying to him, oh, I'll sort that out when I get there. Of course you don't. You stop. You go back because you've been warned. And yet so many people, faced with the awesome unknown, not knowing what's going to happen to them one of these days, and it could be any day, because life is unpredictable, just refuse to think about, what is my life for? Where am I going? What will it all mean? Said that when the first Christian missionaries came to Britain, they went to one of the Anglo-Saxon chiefs, and he was in his mead hall at the time with some of his main leaders that were having a feast, and he called them all together to hear what these Christian missionaries had to say. And they explained to this huddle at the end of the mead hall while the party was going on elsewhere about how they had come to talk about what life was really about. They knew. They were in the light. God had shown them, not because they were special or clever or anything like that, but just because somehow God in his mercy had revealed it to them. What happens after death? What God thinks about us? How God can give us a power and a purpose in life we'd never get from anywhere else? And the chief said, well, what do you think? Shall we let these people preach to our people or not? And just at that moment, it said, a sparrow flew in through the eaves of the mead hall, which had these holes at the ends where the roof and the wall didn't quite meet. And finding itself suddenly in the light, it was just completely disoriented. And it flapped around a bit and then shot like an arrow to the other end and flew out through a hole at the other end. And one of the chiefs pointed to it and said, look, that's what our lives are like, isn't it? We come in out of the darkness. We're in the light for a brief second and we go hurtling out the other side. Nobody's ever been able to explain it to me. If these men know what happens either side, then I vote we let them come and teach. And as a result of that, the gospel spread to England. We became Christianized, and that's why we're here this morning. But it's a big question, isn't it? We're here for a brief moment in the light. What does it all mean? Being in the dark in this world means you don't understand that. Your mind, your will, your emotions, it's all in the darkness. Second point I want to make, though. If this really is a situation, it's the light that gives us power to make an impact on the darkness. You see, it's not just that God has told us something that we now understand. When the light comes into your life, it not only affects your mind, it affects your will and your emotions as well, and you become a different person. If anybody is a Christian, the New Testament says, he, she is a brand new person inside, Living Bible translation. Something has happened to recreate your inside, and so you're different. What happens? Well, Paul says here, doesn't he, the fruit of the light, he's mixing his metaphors, but never mind, what the light produces is in all goodness, righteousness and truth. You become a different kind of person. What's goodness? Well, Martin Lloyd-Jones says this word goodness in the New Testament always stands for a person's character that's perfectly and absolutely balanced. Everything fits together in the right way, just like it does in God. God is good. And because he is perfect in himself, because he's perfectly balanced, he's able to allow his nature, the warmth and love and the compassion of his nature, to flood over into his creation. That's why he made us in the first place, because he wanted to show his goodness to us. And if we reflect his nature, if we're being made back into his likeness, then we're going to become people of goodness as well. We're not going to be concerned about ourselves all the time. We're going to be benevolent. We're going to want to do things for other people. We're going to want to bring sunshine into people's lives wherever we go and really do good for them. There'll be no selfish agenda. I was just reading yesterday and remembering about Jim O'Fixit, to which my daughters used to write letters way back in the 80s. Jimmy Savile, posing on television as everybody's favourite uncle, somebody who'll fix it, somebody who'll make your dreams come true. And he did, for lots of people. But we now know what lay behind that. And the heart of darkness that motivated him to be in touch with young people all the time in the way that he was. There was a selfish agenda at the heart of it. By contrast, Christian goodness is just about no strings attached caring for other people, sharing what we've got, because we didn't deserve it anyway. God's poured it into our lives so it can pour out the other end into the lives of other people too. The fruit of the light is goodness. And so that means goodness in all kinds of practical ways. Goodness to my family, certainly, to those around me, to those in the church, certainly, but going out beyond that too, to my neighbours, to people in Exeter in need whom I wouldn't otherwise meet, to people at the ends of the earth, I can't help other than by sending a Christmas shoebox or giving money to people who are working with them or whatever it happens to be. But that kind of practical pouring out goodness is one of the marks of light in your life. Second one, righteousness. What's that about? Well, righteousness is about God's standards. It's about justice. It's about everything being straight. And somebody who has become a Christian, who's come into the light from the darkness, is somebody whose life is becoming more and more focused on what's right. He burns to see oppression taken out of the way wherever it occurs. She longs to see righteousness at every level of society. But it's not just a case of reading the paper, and, oh, it's dreadful, there ought to be a law. It's a case of getting involved, getting your hands dirty. And in situations, not just necessarily situations nationally and in government and stuff like that, but in personal relationships, bringing righteousness to be involved, helping people to be honest, helping them to do what's fair, helping them to do what's right, and standing up yourself at whatever cost for what's good and right and fair. Not just goodness, but also righteousness. And third, truth. A Christian is supposed to be somebody whose life is becoming more and more consumed by truth. Somebody who's able to be honest, who has no secrets. What you see is what you get. You're on the outside what you are on the inside. You're not manipulating your personality to put your best side forward to the world. You just are good. That's the way it is. And because you're honest, it brings out honesty in other people too. One of the things I've always found is that when you're trying to help somebody who's got a problem, one of the most powerful things you can say is, yeah, I know. I've been there. I get that trouble too. That once happened to me. I've been in that situation. Because when you can be honest about your own struggles and your own difficulties, that helps other people to open up and be honest too. And the more honesty there is, the more openness there is, the more harmony there is as well. And so that's what God wants. Christians who not just come here on a Sunday morning and read the Bible and go away and sing hymns in their bath, but people are out there in the world making a tremendous difference through goodness and righteousness and truth. But there's a third point to make. Oh, well, before we get to that, something Martin Luther King said, and if ever a man was an example of the conflict of good and evil in a life, it was Martin Luther King. But the tremendous things that came out of his grasp of this principle that Christians have got to be good, he said this: darkness cannot drive out darkness. Only light can do that. Hate cannot drive out hate. Only love can do that. If you want to change the world, it's not just a matter of saying, I must have more goodness, I must be righteous, I must be consumed by the need for truth. You can't do it. Only the light can drive out the darkness. And when the light comes into your life, then you can do it. But, third point, it's possible to live on one side as if you belong to the other. It's possible to be a person of light and yet live as if you were still in the darkness. We've talked about the fact it's possible to be in the darkness and look as if you belong to the light, because some people, by a massive effort of willpower or by tremendous just innate goodness, are able to live exemplary lives without God. But that's not what he wants either. What he wants is people who are in the light and act that way. And one of the problems is many Christians just don't. That's why Paul has to say to the Ephesians here, you are in the light. Live as children of light. You've got to do it. Make the light the center of your life, because if you don't, then you're a contradiction in terms and you're not going to help the world. And I wonder, as we go out of here this week, if we're Christians, just how much light is going to be cast into the darkness by us as we go back into a dark world. I don't mean by being judgmental. It might sound that a little bit, mightn't it, when Paul says, have nothing to do with the fruitless deeds of darkness, but rather expose them. That's the kind of stuff the News of the World used to do every Sunday, wasn't it? You know, they get people into compromising situations, and then the reporter would say, so we made our excuses and left. You know, you show it up. You report it. You tell it all over the place. That's not what Paul's saying here. He's not saying talk about it. He says, in fact, it's shameful even to mention what the disobedient do in secret. But everything exposed by the light becomes visible. When you live a life of light, without you needing to say anything about it, it shows up where the darkness is. And the light shines into the darkest corners and gives people a glimpse of a new hope, a new possibility, a new way of being. And that's what God calls us to. But it's possible to live as if you were in the darkness. This is Jim Gant, who was a Green Beret, one of the most decorated soldiers in America. He rose to the rank of major, and he was sent off on a mission to Afghanistan. You might say he doesn't look much like a soldier. Well, yeah, that's what he looked like at the start of his mission. The picture on the left is what he looked like at the end. Why? Well, because basically over some hard, tough years in Afghanistan, and you mustn't take away the pressures, Gant just went native. He became almost an Afghan himself. He started living a life with the tribesmen where he wasn't wearing uniform very often. He was growing his beard and he was becoming a tribal chief. In fact, he was called a Malik, a tribal chief, by the Afghans, who liked him because he was becoming just like them. The problem was that while he was getting close to them, he was becoming less and less like an American soldier. And he started taking pills. He became dependent on drugs to help him get through the tough times. He soon had an alcohol problem. And that, of course, was all against regulations. Even worse, he managed to persuade a war correspondent, Anne Scott Tyson, to come and live with him. Now, that was completely against regulations. She was married with four children. He was married with four children. But the first week he met her, he said, marry me. Of course, marriage was impossible. But she came and lived with him, completely against regulations, and almost became a sort of paramilitary, started wearing fatigues. The two of them together just became an Afghan family. And the army and its regulations and what he was supposed to be doing more or less went out of the window. And in 4 years after all of this had started, a first lieutenant fresh out of West Point was appointed to Gant's squad in Afghanistan. And he sent back a report that just destroyed Gant's career. This is him and his now wife. They have married, actually, back in America now. But at the time, it was what was reported about him was this. He didn't follow any rules. He was definitely erratic. He did not act in a stable manner. And the first lieutenant was saying, look, you've got to get this guy out of here. He's a loose cannon. He's trying to live in two worlds, and you can't live in two worlds. Get him away. He's a liability. And when they checked it out and got him out of the place, bounced him down from major to captain, took away his green beret and quietly retired him from the army, this is what the report said. He's a disgrace with no moral character. He indulged in a self-created fantasy world. We're living in a world in which our fantasies can be lived out for a very long time. A world in which it's possible to amuse yourself to death, to distract yourself from the big questions. And that's possible whether you're a Christian or a non-Christian. You can live life on a very simple kind of level, living in two worlds at the same time, in the light, but as if you're a member of the darkness. End result, you make no impact on the world. You're unstable, you're erratic, and you're making no difference whatsoever. Let me just finish by giving you one last, there are two kinds of people in the world, quote. That's not quite, actually, this one. This is Blaise Pascal, 17th century mathematician, brilliant mind, tremendous philosopher, who had an experience on November the 23rd, 1642, of God just coming into his life in the most amazing way. And he never explained that experience to anybody else, but it changed him completely. We only know about it because he wrote on a piece of paper what had happened and sewed it into the lining of his raincoat, and we found it after he died. But that experience really changed his life. And he began to realize how important it was to know and serve the living and true God. And so he one day wrote this: "There are two kinds of people one can call reasonable. Those who serve God with all their heart because they know him. And those who seek him with all their heart because they do not know him." If you know him, if you're in the light, live as someone in the light. And if you don't know him yet, the darkness is a great place to leave. Let the light shine into your heart and be what God wants you to be.